Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco to discuss the second part of The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. This will be a three-part series of episodes, which we are transitioning from the break we took with some Q&A and some other relevant topics, talking about authority of Scripture and Jordan Peterson on truth a little while ago. And after this, I think we will be moving into a series on vocation. I think that may be our unique spin to add to Lewis's work here from a Lutheran or from the Thinking Fellows perspective on things. And last episode, we talked about the chapter Men Without Chests. My dad summed up what the Men Without Chests means at the end of that episode. Maybe I'll have you redo that part here just to give people a refresher, or maybe we have first-time listeners catching in. If you are a first-time listener, you should check out the other projects at 1517. You can go to 1517.org, see the homepage there. There we have daily blog, preaching helps, we have videos, usually the latest conferences or public talks that people in our fellowship are giving are available to see there as well, in addition to the, I think, just shy of 20 podcasts that we have actively on our network right now. So you can go check that all out. That's 1517.org. So chapter 2 is titled In Mine, which is a first edition. The Abolition, yeah.
How many times is he going to say that?
I don't know.
Every episode.
Did you know this is the only first edition book I own of any book? Unless my library has one and I don't know about it. So I'm allowed to like this book, or the copy I have. It's titled The Way, which in The Way, he's talking about the Tao, which is another way of saying the way, which we've also said is another way of saying the good or
the true
or something like this.
The beautiful.
I think it's kind of funny that the book's about the objectivity of language, and then we have the Tao, which can be interpreted as like four different meanings.
Right? Well, I think it technically just does mean the way, right, Adam?
It just means the way.
Yeah. It does. You know, so this is an interesting thing because there's this religion, if you will, or worldview called Taoism. And the Tao Te Ching is its sort of central text. And I don't know if it's the first line, but it's close to the beginning. It says something like, the Tao or the way that can be named or described is not the way. So it's like elusive and so on. But at the same time, the Tao or the way is also part of the Confucian tradition. And Lewis,
right,
chapter 2 begins with a quotation from Confucius' Analects, Confucius being the yeah, great, I think he's like 5th century BC, Chinese classical thinker. And there were, I mean, for up until the rise of communism in China with Mao Zedong, there were always Confucian exams for civil servants and so on. So it's very integral to classical Chinese civilization. And so for Confucius, the Tao is what we would call, like you said before, the good, the true, and the beautiful, or natural law,
the
or
right way of
just
living.
What is right, or mm-hmm, yeah, yeah. So and we did say last episode, is this the time, Caleb, where we would talk more about you know, defining that, but also because your dad said that it was unfortunate that he chose the word the Tao, I think.
Yeah.
Didn't you say that?
I did, yeah.
Scott, yeah.
I think it's, yeah, maybe it's unfortunate. I think it's probably part of this World War sort of, I think Lewis, as much as he's critiquing the Green Book and maybe some of the philosophy there, also shares some of the letting go of the old gods, as they would be described, and sort of the harm that civilization has by ascribing too much to these. And so I think he does have what we would call a global worldview, right?
Yeah.
And very pluralistic. A society can really survive in this pluralistic environment if we share a commonality, natural law, the Tao, something like this. And I think he's kind of optimistic about that. I could be wrong, but it seems like that really is what the world and Europe in particular after World War One, in order to try to find a hope in something, was pretty optimistic about, sort of letting go of some of the things that caused the war, some of the attachments that caused wars, having a global community sort of united by something at the bottom level. And for many people, that was undefined. And for Lewis, that was more defined. But in order to exist within that pluralistic framework, he adopts something like the Tao to describe truth.
Maybe it is unfortunate that he used that term, but I think if he's trying to defend, especially in chapter two, he starts to do it already in chapter one, but chapter two is primarily dedicated to it. If he's trying to defend that there is some sort of objective foundation to things, a universal truth, if you will, though we might not have direct access to it unless God reveals it directly to us or through some sort of historic revelation or something. I think the choice of using the Tao was at least rhetorically savvy, because he's borrowing from a civilization that I don't know how much he knew about Chinese civilization or Eastern or Asian civilization, but he's purposely choosing that to show that this is not just something within the Western civilization. Yeah. This is a global, as you said, right. Caleb, a global, a universal thing. And yeah. I didn't ask this last time because I didn't want to belabor the episode because we're getting long. But I know we've had this conversation before. But Lewis is really betraying his 20th century Christian Platonism here.
That was sort of my point. He can list the Tao all he wants, but when he makes his case, he's going to Plato. You know, so that thing that can sort of get us to sort of what Caleb was saying, if he is sort of making an argument for living in peace pluralistically, that thing that can get us to the point where we can do that for Lewis is going to be a good Western education.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Though I would also add, and I don't know if it's in the first edition, Caleb, you could tell us as you're so proud of that.
I regret saying it. Oh my gosh. But
my editions of The Abolition of Man, which were, of course, much cheaper to purchase and published more recently.
Probably have less errors in them.
Has a pretty extensive appendix. That covers ancient Babylonian literature and so on.
It's called the Illustrations of the Tao from
across the world.
Yep. So. Yes. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't have the first edition.
No, I actually think it's that appendix which sort of leads me to believe in this sort of pluralistic liberal society ideal that, you know.
But they're illustrations of natural law
that are
collected. And so, again, he can call it the Tao sort of for this.
Yeah.
I'm kind of getting outside of myself here, guys. I'm making a point that this is extant everywhere. But when he gets to it, he uses, you know, Platonic Aristotelian language to describe it.
Don't you think in mere Christianity, he makes a Christian argument for truth here, and that the audience, now he's trying to make a appeal where he's saying my biases towards Christianity are not the appeal to truth. I can make an appeal to philosophers and educators who don't share my basis for universal truth, the scripture, Christ. You have it. I'll go to something that doesn't require these for society, for the realm of education.
I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that seems like that would be.
I also think there is something to using the language of another quote unquote system to make the case that many of these things are universal. Adam, did you ever teach the basic theo class at the university?
No, they didn't let lay people such as myself touch theology. But lay people like you, they did.
That's weird. Maybe that's why special. They always made me do it for the transfers. But it was... Yeah, I know me. Transfers. It was interesting that you'd always get... So I didn't do a lot of time on moralism in that class, because I honestly felt like, especially since I was doing the transfer, so many of them were not Christian. It was a lot of time was better spent talking about the core fundamentals of Christianity. But at the end of the day, as I was kind of given the material that I had to cover, sort of ethics, you might say, was definitely in there. And it was always funny to me that when you'd go to ethics, you know, you'd make the argument, let's even say you take the second table of law from the Decalogue, you take sort of like the moral commandments regarding how we treat one another. You would say, and I would say, because it's true, that, you know, take for instance, thou shalt not murder, is a sort of universal principle, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can make an argument that nearly every society, or actually every society on Earth, has had rules about murder. They might not apply to everybody. Like, certain people might be non-people.
Well, that's the point. So I'd always have these students that are non-Christian, and that, you know, I always felt like they knew where I was going. They're like, this dude's going to get to sex at some point, and I got to stop him before he starts telling me that adultery and fornication are wrong. So they'd always stop you, like, at murder. And they'd say, well, not every culture has murder wrong. There's some cultures, and, you know, of course, because they're sophomoric, they're definitionally sophomoric, they'd be like, the Mayans would practice human sacrifice. And
to commemorate that pyramid-like thing at Tenochtitlan, the Aztecs, I think they sacrificed up to 50,000 people in one day.
Yeah.
You know, those noble savages know, that we Europeans.
And so this exception to my rule was also supposed to disprove the rule, right? Whereas in reality, within both of those cultures, the Mayan and the Aztec culture, there were still rules against murder.
It's regulated.
You know, that's different than the state saying in those instances, you're going to die because you're a sacrifice. That's not technically speaking murder.
Well, they change what's happening, right? So the person is no longer just a person where on the street, you and me get into a conflict, I kill you, it's wrong. That person's now a other object. They are a sacrifice. And a sacrifice has meaning and a purpose in a place and can only be done, you know,
and it's not murder. And not the case. It may be murderous. It's killing for sure, but it's not like that's defined. Thou shalt not murder. It's not murder.
There are universal laws against murder. The arbitrary taking of life.
Yes. Against theft.
That's universal.
Against
in terms of killing, there are. I mean, there's lots of nuance there, but murder is universally prohibited. Yeah. Has always been.
And one might even say, you know, like the in our numbering the sixth commandment, adultery too. Now, whereas that may be sort of defined differently by governments and other places, typically, if you're living in a society that has any sort of societal or governmental organization, these things have historically been to some degree regulated. Like if you're married, you're married, and there are rules too. How you get married and where you get married and when you get married. And once you're married, that you're married to just that person, or that you can be married to two people. But typically, I'm not arguing for this, people, but typically you dude can be married to several people and you get lady, cannot, you can only be married to the one guy. And
and even with that, like it's to get to sort of the chapter about, it's like emotional meaning, the emotional meaning of marriage or relationships to people today has erased the contractual meaning. When you talk to people about marriage, nobody acknowledges that they're entering a legal contract with another individual that the state has an interest in maintaining. And so when you talk about divorce, you talk about, oh, I'm not being treated right. I don't feel loved anymore. I don't whatever. It's all emotional appeal. And I've recently seen some divorce, and they go, you're violating a legal contract that you've entered in. Like, this is as much as you feel hurt or this person feels hurt, like somebody is violating a contract, and the reason it's a contract is because it causes harm to you, your children, and the people around you, and then maybe makes those
in most cases, by the way, society as a whole, because the amount of sort of general societal expense that has to be put into that family to maintain the children is now greater because it's not a unit supporting it, it's usually an individual.
Or two individuals, and that has to be regulated by the state in order to determine how much support
your
goes
where. Your marriage has now cost court time, lawyer time, arbitrator time, on and on. So, I don't know how we got there.
Abolition of man.
Just to clarify, I am not arguing for polygamy. I have never understood it. having been married 28 years now.
So long enough to know you don't want a second wife.
Oh, did I say that? I did not say that, Adam. My goodness. All right.
So what are we talking about?
The way, abolition of man. I think there was a tie-in there, and I think it was a tie-in just to the fact that what he's arguing here, essentially then at the end of the day four, because we got into natural law, is a sort of a universal set of principles, usually moral or ethical in nature, that are indeed universal and that cannot be violated without expense.
I think...
Yes.
That's the important part. And I think that's where it butts up to the limits of what a natural law does. The law can identify when it's been violated, right? And so that's sort of the – and so what the opposite party here, what the Green Book or what society after the Green Book looks like, is saying that those identifications are incorrect, or that those identifications might not be nuanced enough or take into account individual – cases and things like that, that the universal improperly identifies the wrong people. It might work for the majority, but it doesn't work for these people.
Although, can I just say that if I were not a Christian, how do you feel about this, Adam? If I were not a Christian, that's how I got Adam to get off his phone, everyone out there. If I were not a Christian, surprising that it's down, I would have a harder time with Lewis's argument than I do, because I'm kind of with Wittgenstein on this one. Unless at the end of the day, this were to come from the outside, you can make sort of a practical case from principles of harm avoidance that these things are universal, just that they're practically good, and that if I live according to these rules, I'll likely be more prosperous and will encounter less harm. But that's different than they're universally right and wrong, which I think really only comes because they're sort of, I think that the technical term is deontological in nature, that they've come, or divine decree, they've come via divine decree at the end of the day. And this divine decree is reflected, as Paul says, in our hearts. And that's the reason why these principles are so natural, quote unquote, natural and or universal.
I would add to that, Paul's identification of the natural law is in its function as identifying wrong, not in making good.
Yeah, correct.
And so there's a limit to natural law. It cannot make people good. It can only identify that something is wrong.
It can act as a curb, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Scott, you asked me what I felt, and nobody ever asked me how I feel.
Feel? I meant thought. So yeah. get over yourself a little bit.
You guys went to public school, right? That's how you guys talk about feelings.
Yeah.
I forget the question now.
Well, just the idea that...
So I might be a little... I might not be answering this directly because it's been... I don't remember the question exactly, but... I think you're right that if, you know, a non-Christian, like if you're reading Lewis, especially today, but maybe even the 1940s, like Lewis's argument for and defense of natural law would, of course, make sense to a Christian. Would it make sense to a non-Christian? A person from China, for example, even though he's using the term Tao. Good. I don't know. I don't know. I think so. Back in the 20th century, I think it would move somebody.
Oh, I think
now,
it probably
no,
would too.
Heavens no.
I don't
think anybody cares at all about anything.
Saying personally, if I take God out of this, if I take sort of not just God, but the divine decrees, say, the Decalogue out, my knowledge of the Decalogue out of this, these are interesting ideas, which which you could probably argue me into them being universal, right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I'm not sure you can argue me into them being sort of ontologically good of themselves, other than the fact that if I were to live my life according to these, they work and it'll afford me a certain amount of harm avoidance, which sort of when you're teaching kids about ethics is like, that's level 1 out of 10.
That's fables, right?
Is harm avoidance.
You know.
Yeah. I'm going to answer as a historian and as somebody who's trying to figure out our modern culture, because aren't we doing a little cultural criticism, what do we call it, which is dangerous for us. Yeah. I think back when Lewis is writing, that's still in the air. Because even though there's this sort of new philosophy in the Green Book and stuff is all kind of in the water now, people are in England, where Lewis is writing and lecturing, are still reading the greats, or the what Lewis would have called the greats, or the classics. And natural law, the principle of practical reason, or whatever you want to call the Tao, and he gives a whole bunch of other names for it towards the end of chapter two, is still something that's sort of part and parcel of at least elevated public discourse. Today, I think you're right. I think the philosophy behind the Green Book has, you know, it eventually won in a way, but then I think in that sort of vacuum that it created, all sorts of new things sort of begin to sprout that are hostile to any sense of there being universal objective values.
Don't you think part of it, though, is that these things don't always result in more prosperity? I mean, people worse than me prosper better than me all the time. People who get political, there's people who have caused murders or maybe participated in themselves who, from a worldly point of view, are going to be much more prosperous
for a time
than you. Yeah. But if you take eternity out of the equation...
I'm not even taking eternity. I'm taking a lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, like, maybe. I'm just saying, if you short-sighted here, I think it gets down to consequences. And if there are ways for those consequences to be avoided, either temporarily or for the majority of your life, or maybe even your whole life, there's not much preventing you from doing any of these things to your gain.
So this is what Lewis says, just because Adam alluded to it. He says, I draw the following conclusions. This thing, which I have called for convenience the Tao, and which others may call natural law, or traditional morality, or first principles of practical reason, or the first platitudes, is not one among a series of possible systems of value. It is the sole source of all value judgments. If it is rejected, all value is rejected. If any value is retained, it is retained. The effort to refute it and to raise a new system of value in its place is self-contradictory. There has never been and never will be a radically new judgment of value in the history of the world. Now, I agree with that because I think you very much can see that what postmodernism has got us is a deconstruction, not construction. So when he says you will never construct anything new that will replace this, it's true. That doesn't mean that there won't be efforts to deconstruct this and to continually deconstruct. Where I sort of as a Christian and my understanding of it, of Christianity, kind of get in the way here, is this idea that it is the sole source of all value judgments. What I'm more comfortable with sort of as a Christian is saying God is that source of all value judgments, who has shared those with us via his word.
And regulates the world by the law.
And regulates those by the law and has written some of these onto our hearts. Those that he's written onto our hearts are the ones that we now see reflected universally throughout the world.
Yeah, I'd agree 100%. And through the Zoom, maybe we can fist bump.
Well, I actually think this is really good for Christians because the universally regulated, the natural law universally regulates this world is why the church is different, right? That's like why the gospel is different, because this world is actually universally always regulated by the law. And so God actually breaks through with a different word. But in the case of this world, in the case of societies, cultures, even postmodernism, after it deconstructs, has to regulate. We see that time and time again. It has to regulate. And so it's going to appeal to some sort of law between you, me, and every other creature.
Yeah. Well, I'm not making necessarily an eschatological point the way that, like some sort of premillennial folk or person would. But until the spirit of lawlessness is released, mm-hmm. and the real antinomos, this is just me. I think we're living in an age of, I know you all, I'm sure I get critiqued for, nobody would say it to my face because I'll choke them, but get accused for being antinomian. But you want to talk about it. I think we live in an antinomian age in that There's been a concerted effort or attempt to not only to work against not just God's revealed law, certainly that's the case, that's been for the case for some time, but also just basic natural law and some sort of new man-made law that even defies the obvious laws of biology is the age we're living in.
I mean, again,
this is not an eschatological point, but I think we're, to put it in very scholarly terms, we're hosed.
No, I think you're right.
I don't know if there's been a better time to live in terms of conveniences and technology and so on and so forth.
Healthcare.
Whatever. Yeah. But at the same time, it's a very dangerous time in terms of,
for many of the same reasons.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, yeah. And maybe this can get to the vocation, because sort of this ultimate sense of value, which I sort of really want to ascribe at the end of the day to God, when that is lost, value is replaced by convenience, feelings. So why, I mean, even to your point of sort of biological truths being rejected, they're being rejected not on, and this is what Lewis argues at the end of this chapter, not on the basis of an argument to refute the idea of the truth there, but on the basis of, I don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. You're not getting sort of a counter argument to the argument that just even say boys are boys and have a particular biology that reflects that, and girls are girls and have another particular biology that reflects that. You're not getting a counter argument to that proposition. You're getting a response that is, but I don't feel that way. And in not feeling that way, I'm not going to act that way and won't be referred to that way. And you now have to change, you know, and it just gets to be, okay, so convenience is, it's great because even up here on the mountain, Amazon still delivers. But you know, convenience is also a problem because it's just so convenient to let go of everything and just satisfy, your own whim from moment to moment, to give yourself over to what Paul calls unnatural.
Are you familiar with the book by Carl Truman, published like the last couple of years, Making of the Modern Self, I think is the title?
Yeah.
Yep.
Where, I mean, it's a big book, but one of his, I think his argument is that in our day and age, how one feels, how every individual feels is what determines what's real. I mean, that's,
And it's irrefutable. I can't tell you that whatever you testified to me feelings-wise is incorrect. I can't tell you that's not how you feel. The thing is that maybe I can appeal to you why you shouldn't act on those feelings, though. And that's sort of where I think some of the conversation from people who maintain objective universals get lost, is saying that the feelings are invalid, or maybe that's not how you really feel, you've been conditioned to feel that way, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, I don't really know if that's true or not. You may be lying about those feelings. Those feelings may be completely valid. However, I can advise you not to act on certain feelings. Just like I can tell somebody who's angry not to go, you know, kill the person they're angry with.
Well, that's the ultimate contradiction here, is that there are still some feelings, hate, right, that we are not supposed to act on. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we're not supposed to act on them is less clear than it would have been if the quote-unquote system hadn't been destroyed, that Lewis is arguing for here, hadn't been destroyed altogether.
Yeah.
There are many feelings we're not supposed to act on.
And that's,
bigotry, hatred, homophobia, those are all feelings, and they're not supposed to be acted on. And I think, you know, in all those three cases, rightly so. But at the end of the day, how do we figure out, how do we arbitrate which feelings are still just and which are unjust? And this is the problem. I think it's, you know, I feel like I spent too much time criticizing Lewis in this, so I'm going to praise him a little bit here, because he wrote this in 1943. We're now in 2022, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So almost 80 years later, right? I'm not a math person, but that feels like 80 years to me. So This is what he says. Now get this. You say we shall have no values at all if we step outside the Tao. Or this sort of somebody's critiquing, right? Very well. We shall probably find that we can get on quite comfortably without them. Let us regard all ideas of what we ought to do simply as an interesting psychological survival. Let us step right out of all that and start doing what we like. Let us decide for ourselves what a man is to be and to make him into that, not on any ground of imagined value.
Well, I think this comment is really interesting because it touches on stuff that we've been doing on Outlaw God lately, which is ontology and sort of ontology is you are what you do. Luther making a counterpoint against this, that it's not you are what you do. And this is what this person's arguing for.
You are what God says you are.
You are what God says you are. Your ontology is what God says you are. It has to actually come from outside of you. If ontology, if your being comes from inside of you, you're going to end up in this situation that this critic of Lewis is talking about, which is every person has to make themselves, and they have to make themselves in their own image.
Yes.
And they have to constantly do. They can never hear what they are. And when you tell them what they are, they'll be offended. And they'll hate you for it.
So a few years ago when the hashtag Me Too stuff was really blowing up, I was at a speaking engagement, and a part of this is it was a weekend thing. And so you kind of hang out and sit around and drink beers and talk with the people afterwards. And some people were having a discussion about Me Too and were really sort of in favor of the retributive aspects of it. You know, in other words, not just the protective aspects, which I would say were very beneficial, right? I have a daughter and a wife. I don't want really them to live in a world where men feel like they can do anything that they want to them sexually or otherwise and get away with it without punishment. I don't want to live in that world. So there was parts of the Me Too movement that I actually thought were pretty good. But then I started hearing some arguments that were, well, it doesn't matter, you know, guilt doesn't matter, actual proof and evidence doesn't matter, truth doesn't matter, because men had it their way for so long, it's time for us to have our turn. And it was real retributive, right? In other words, even if men are being
falsely accused
now, that's okay because men in the past have themselves falsely accused and or gotten away with it. Yeah. And I said, you know, you have to be real careful with that because you live in a society right now where the people that are being accused and honestly, not even if you're being accused, but you're kind of being, at that time, I don't know if people remember how intense it was when it first started happening. This was the time when like toxic masculinity commercials and everything were coming out because at that point in time, being connected to being a man that was seen as being quote unquote manly or masculine in some way was associated with being an abuser. Right. And I said, just because sort of, this is happening now and people are okay with it doesn't mean that if you treat three generations of men like this, that they'll be okay with it. And their retribution has a tendency to slip the other way. So it's actually better to act on a principle. So I'm making Lewis's argument here to act on a good principle, which is this is unjust towards women when men act this way. And that has to be stopped, and not a bad principle. Whereas all men need to be punished because women were abused or are being abused. I mean, both of these things are wrong. And so what you stand for here is the fighting for what's right, as we know it from Lewis calls it the Tao. I'd call it God's law, but whatever.
I want to fist bump you again to the Zoom, but amen. Amen. The charge of toxic masculinity is starting to ratchet up again. And I look at it and think, you know, what's defined as toxically masculine is so like squishy and broad and, you know, such that it would cancel out the sort of the things you need.
Well, you could say to keep evil at bay.
To win against the Nazis, to fight against ISIS, to maybe I don't know anything about Russia and Ukraine, but maybe to deal with whatever's ensuing there.
And maybe it's only men without chests that are being accepted. And it's men with chests, as Lewis defines it, you know, those people that have been taught to manage between their emotions and their rationality and to identify that, as he, again, as he calls it, the Tao, and to, and have the courage to act on it. It's that exact courage that is sometimes looked down upon because, to go back to the quote, we're making men as we want them to be, not
as they are
from the Paulson podcast, as God has declared them to be, or as they are. Okay, I'll stop now.
Well, it's interesting. The Me Too example is good because the retribution that was being proposed in some cases was universal. Like you said, whether the guilt was actual or not, through, you know, these are people who would laugh at the idea that through one man, all men fell. Right, that you could have inherited sin. They would laugh at the idea of inherited sin, and then punish men for the inherited sins of other men.
Yes. Oh, good point. Really good point.
You know, that's one kind of funny thing, because they're making some sort of universal appeal that this applies to all men.
Yes.
That this type of sin,
and that the benefit of the past applied to all men.
Yeah.
Right. And now, and it didn't.
Yeah. And it didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I noticed is when you made your initial appeal about why this mattered to you at all, why would you even look at an article titled Me Too? You appealed to your vocations as a husband and as a father. The reason that this had particular meaning, the reason why you might want to act about the on the information or investigate the information is because there are people in your life who rely on you who may be harmed.
Yeah.
On this. And if we don't have those, we have no reason to investigate. And for, I would say, for a huge portion of why did things like the Me Too stuff happen for so long? Because people don't have those types of dependencies. They don't have people to care about and look out for. They've removed themselves from their families. Many, you know, people remove themselves from family units. They don't want those overbearing patriarchs of fathers to have any say in their life, or their mom who's too opinionated. So I'm going to exile myself from my own family. I'm not going to have my own kids. I'm not going to have a husband. I need to focus on me. And as we get more and more detached from these particular relationships where people care for you, look out for you, have a dependency on and with you, harm can come to you more easily because there's nobody thinking about you. There's nobody who you can call out to because you have removed yourself from that. And sort of that individualistic, I am the value, I need to focus on me and not these attachments, these people, causes the situations where sexual predators can get away with things for years.
Well, it's like the argument. So when I talk about vocation, I talk about concentric circles working their way outward, right? So go from the smaller circles with your family, to your friend circle, to your coworkers, to your neighborhood, to your city, to your county, to your, eventually you get to the whole world. Now with, say, take the Me Too example, does it bother me that women that I've never met, and will never meet, have been and are being abused by men in the workplace and other areas? Yes, it bothers me. Can I do anything about those sort of universal examples? Not really, because I wasn't abusing in the first place, which is the behavior I can really control. Would it bother me more if it were people that I loved? Of course it was, because that's actually how vocation works. God puts people directly into your lives for you to love and to care for. And in order to love and to care for them, they have to be there right in front of you. So you're looking at them. It's kind of like the same reason why parents are more capable to raise their children than are other people. I mean, good parents, at least, right, Adam? Because, you know, and I think I've heard this once from a report of a school board meeting where a parent was saying, I love this. I love my child more than you do. And one of the school board members says, no, we love your child just as much as you do. And the parent's response is, really? What's their name?
You know,
I mean, our listeners can't sense it, but I'm getting all riled up here. I'm just,
I can see you're getting real twitchy in that moving seat over there.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think the vocational aspect of this does play out in person to person relationships. that is vocation, right? Yeah. You can do nothing to serve God for your own salvation or otherwise, but the good news is he puts people in your lives that you can serve, and in serving them, you do serve him.
Yeah. I mean, when you're not doing that, what is your time? Like, what do you got the time left for now?
TikTok.
How did we get here? What more do we need to say? Because we have about 5 minutes, 4 minutes,
oh, 3 minutes.
Abolition of man.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the second chapter, I mean, something maybe worth talking about, we did talk about in the first episode too, is Lewis makes very clear, he's very transparent, that everything he's doing in Abolition of Man, the book, is not even an indirect argument for theism.
Yeah.
He's just, what he's doing is defending sort of the
First principles.
Right. I was going to say what others would say today, the properly basic foundations to any civilization.
Yeah, I think that's
accurate. That there is, we'll all disagree on the details, but there is an objective good, an objective true, and an objective beautiful.
And that, like you said before in the last episode, that the veneer of that civilization is very thin.
Very.
And that if you start violating these, things will go awry quickly.
Yeah, read world history and you will, I mean, that's the lesson to be learned. Civilization is a thin veneer. Human beings are, as Christians have always taught, as the scriptures teach from the first book in the Bible, are depraved. Totally, yeah, depraved, I mean, creatures.
That's the thing, right? Is that without that theism, or more specifically, without the Christian scriptures, God, forgiveness of sins in Christ, you have this law which tells you there is a good, there is a true, there is a beautiful, but it's not making anybody, it's not making any of us, not making any of those civilizations good,
right,
or beautiful, or adherence of the truth. And right, all of human history is to the contrary. And so natural law helps us identify when it's been violated, when the good is, when the bad has broken the good, when the ugly has evaded the beautiful, and when lies have overcome the truth. But
ooh, that's very nice, the way you put that. Yeah,
yeah,
I like that.
Oh, thank you.
Good job. I like that a lot, actually. Can you repeat it?
Repeat it? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'll listen to the episode. But that's the limit.
Yeah.
And the limit is sort of this this knowledge of the downfall. And in this lecture, Lewis doesn't get around to it, but ultimately, I mean, perhaps one problem is it doesn't leave you with hope unless you try to make natural law do more than it can.
Yeah.
In order to reshape the thin veneer, it can't do that. It can't make people. So you have to come in with this other word, a word that Lewis knows intimately and ultimately made him and pulled him out of materialism, and pulled him out of a world where the whole world was himself and his problems.
Yeah,
that's an outstanding ending.
There,
I think.
Job, Caleb.
Fist bump.
Thanks, guys.
Boom.
Boom. Maybe in a couple of years I'll listen to this and not want to cower. So
maybe.
How many years have we've been doing this? Is it 5 or 6?
I think it's actually 7.
Oh my. So wouldn't it be amazing if 7 years from now we're still doing it? And then maybe 14 years after we're dead, at least your dad and I are dead, people are writing books about the worldview of the Thinking Fellows or something like that.
Oh, golly.
Please don't.
That'd be terrifying. They go through our personal records.
Perhaps the benefit of audio and digital files is that they won't last forever.
That they'll be forgotten.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. Unless we get really famous, then somebody will cull through everything to find something to hold against us.
That's what I'll say the next
time.
That'd
be very easy to do.
Says, can you turn an episode into a book? I'll say, no, I really don't want this to last forever. That would be the...
I had dinner with Jeff Mallinson, who used to host Virtue in the Wasteland, and he said he still gets questions about that.
Wow.
A bunch of the stuff that they said on there, and he said, you know, I thought that if we were doing this on a podcast, I could do it because I could just like say it and it would go away.
Nope.
Stuff
I posted on Facebook, satire I posted on Facebook 8, maybe 9 years ago, still come back to haunt me.
That's why I don't post on Facebook.
Yeah, well, I don't have Facebook anymore. Do you have Facebook?
I think
as a formality.
Okay.
I have Facebook that I don't know how to get into.
Yeah. Well, guys, hey, thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast. If you'd like to find out more about the Thinking Fellows and 1517 and our other projects there, you can go to 1517.org. If you would like to support this show, it is a donor-funded show. We are not able to do this or the 19 other podcasts that 1517 has, or the daily blogs, or the sermon helps, or the videos, or the conferences, without donors like you. You can go to 1517.org/donate to help support us there. And if you'd like to support us in another way, you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Even if you do not use the Apple Podcasts app for your regular listening, you can leave a review there, and those greatly help us in our search results. We appreciate you listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.